Welcome. How's everybody doing? I hope several of you have gotten your vaccines by now. Today's podcast is about our upcoming Nordic program with music from Finnish composer Rautavaara, the Icelandic composer Johan Johansson, and the most famous Finnish composer of all, Jean Sibelius. I personally started getting fascinated with Finnish music during my time as associate conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. You might wonder, LA, Hollywood, and Finland? Well, in this case, it has nothing to do with the movie industry. It had to do with the music director of the LA Philharmonic at the time, my boss, Esa-Pekka Salonen, who is Finnish. To me, he was the ultimate Finnish artist, always dressed in black, quiet, intense, calm. He rarely talked. When he did, everybody was listening. His interpretations of Sibelius were a tour de force, from whimsical to brutal. My fascination with Nordic music continued later in my career. Early on, during my time as music director of the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra, I got enamored with Iceland. The reasons were twofold. First, Winnipeg has the biggest Icelandic population outside of Iceland, and the only department of Icelandic studies at a university outside of Iceland, worldwide. Lots of Icelanders came to Winnipeg at the beginning of the 20th century during a time of intense economic hardships and poverty in Iceland. They got settled in Gimli. Gimli is an hour north of Winnipeg, a point of pilgrimage for many Icelandic visitors. The second reason was my friend, the Canadian composer Matthew Patton, who opened for me the door to the actual sound world of Iceland. Before that, to be honest, I had no idea about the tremendous musicality of the Icelandic people and the music coming out of this small country. What I learned was that the music from Iceland is unique worldwide. One of the reasons is its isolation. Composers and songwriters are not so much bound to traditions or schools like on the continents. The outcome is a style of writing that is homogeneous and Renaissance-like. Back to my story. My friend was insistent in his passion towards Iceland, with the result that we booked a trip to Reykjavik, financed by the Icelandic consulate, to meet Icelandic composers and musicians. It was wonderful. In the middle of May, we experienced the rough and cold weather of the north. We visited the sound studio of the famous Icelandic singer Björk and had breakfast with the pianist from the band Sigur Rós. We attended several concerts at the newly built concert hall right at the waters of the North Atlantic. And on the last day, my flight had to be postponed for 24 hours because of the eruption of a volcano. What else could I have wished for? As I said, before all of this, I didn't know about the power of Nordic music. But what an eye-opener. In a nutshell, slow developments, deep, emotional, tonal. All of this led to an Icelandic festival at the time with the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra, with music of several Icelandic composers and musicians, and a pilgrimage of most of them to Gimli. Back to our program. The first piece is called Cantus Arcticus, Concerto for Birds by the Finnish composer Rautavaara. It is indeed a concerto for orchestra and actual bird calls, recorded around the Arctic Circle in Finland. Bird sounds in classical concerts? Well, if you think about it, it is not so unusual. The only unusual part is that we will actually use a recording that is going to be played together with the orchestra's performance. Several composers before wrote bird calls into their works. Antonio Vivaldi comes to mind in his Four Seasons. He imitates different sounds from chicken to songbirds. Beethoven, at the end of the slow movement of his Pastoral Symphony, he uses the nightingale, quail and cuckoo in rhythmic ways flowing in and out of the composition. Another Italian comes to mind, Ottorino Respighi. He actually uses the recording of a nightingale in his Pines of Rome. The composer who was most obsessed with bird calls was the French composer Olivier Messiaen in the 20th century. Messiaen was highly religious and regarded birds as the messengers of God. He actually recorded bird songs, then slowed down the recordings in order to write out the actual pitches. Based on those discoveries, Messiaen built several of his works. One of them, Epode, from Chronochromie, where each of the 18 violins is playing a different bird song. Back to our composer, Rautavaara, our composer from Finland, the country of 180,000 lakes, saunas, and one of the best ice hockey teams in the world. Rautavaara was born in Helsinki in 1928. He studied with Aaron Copland, Americans Aaron Copland, at Tanglewood, the famous summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra in the Berkshire Mountains. After that, in the 50s, he went to the Juilliard School in New York City, where his fellow students were Philip Glass and Steve Reich, the godfathers of minimalism. Rautavaara composed 9 operas, 1 ballet, 8 symphonies, and 12 concerti. And he taught for 30 years at the Sibelius Academy in Helsinki. In other words, he was busy. Several of his works were characterizations of celestial beings. Rautavaara said in an interview, "It is my belief that music is great if, at some point, the listener catches a glimpse of eternity through the window of time. This, to my mind, is the only true justification for all art. Everything else is of secondary importance." In a different interview, Rautavaara talks about his composition process. He says, "When I was teaching composition at the Sibelius Academy in Helsinki, I used to warn my students, don't ever try to force your music, because music is very wise. It has its own will. It knows where to go. You have to listen to it, to listen to your material, which you have chosen. Start with that, and then the material will dictate where it wants to go. It's much wiser than you are. Don't push yourself, but try to find out what the music wants to become. Maybe that doesn't work with everybody, but for me, with my temperament, at least it does. I feel very humble in front of my music." Cantus Arcticus was commissioned by the University of Oulu in 1972. It is one of his most played compositions. The work has 3 movements: the bog, melancholy, with the sounds of the shore lark, and swans migrating with the sounds of whooper swans. The birds are the soloists. The first movement starts with the orchestra in the foreground and the birds in the background. The sounds of marsh birds, recorded during spring migration, becomes more and more prevalent. The strings join at some point in a lush romantic melody. It feels like a musical painting of somebody walking in the wild. Guevara gives very specific instructions for some of the instruments. In the flutes, he writes, "Think of autumn and of Tchaikovsky." And of the muted trombones, he writes, "Try to imitate the staccato of the cane heard later in the recording." At the string entrance, he writes, "The strings finally come in with an ample melody like the inner voices of someone walking in a foreign land." In the second movement, Melancholy, he uses a slowed-down recording of two shore larks calling back and forth to one another by four times. The orchestra is in the background. The larks are the soloists. And finally, in the last movement, Swans Migrating, he composes four orchestral groups that slowly are coming together in one long crescendo, then decrescendo. He says, "I imagine the swans fly straight to the burning sun." The second piece on the program is by Icelandic composer Jóhann Jóhannsson, called Fordlandia. As I said earlier, there is something very special about the music coming from this little island in the North Atlantic. I certainly love its purity and depth. Jóhann Jóhannsson lived from 1969 to 2018. He became famous in the last 7 years through his nomination for the Academy Awards for the movie Sicario, and his win of the Golden Globe for his music to the movie The Theory of Everything. Remember the biopic about Stephen Hawking with the actor Eddie Redgrave? Jóhann grew up in Reykjavik, where he played in different indie rock bands until he started a solo career. His first solo album received good reviews. Pitchfork described the music as exceptionally restrained, the piano moving like droplets off of slowly melting icicles, the violin breathing warmth from above. I was lucky to catch Johann's rising star before it became too famous and expensive. In 2012, during that Icelandic festival in Winnipeg I talked earlier about, I conducted the world premiere of Prayer to the Dynamo by Johansson, a beautiful minimalist score about the beginning of technology. Jóhann says about composition, "It's about putting yourself in a receptive state of mind where you react to inputs. And it can be from anywhere. It doesn't really matter if you're writing for film or if you're doing your own piece. You always have to put yourself into that space." Fordlandia, the work of our program, was Johann's sixth full-length studio album from 2008. It is about the failure of Henry Ford's Brazilian rubber plant. Yes, you heard it correctly. The failure of Henry Ford's Brazilian rubber plant. The music was not music for a film. It was conceived purely musically. Let's call it an ambient tone poem. First, about the historical background. In 1926, Henry Ford bought 2.5 million acres of land in the Amazon forest for Fordlandia, a planned factory and city for its workers to elude the British monopoly over the supply of rubber at the time. The rubber was, of course, used for all the tires of his Model T, which were built, amongst many other factories, in the Oklahoma City Ford Motors Assembly Plant, currently known as Oklahoma City's 21C Museum Hotel. Henry Ford had many Brazilian workers and their families come to live in Fordlandia. But Too much time and money was spent on recreating a beautiful American town than working out how to successfully grow rubber in the Amazon, including building a 150-foot water tower despite being in the middle of the rainforest. Henry Ford created a planned community with a hospital, school, library, hotel, swimming pool, playground, and golf course in an area that was only accessible by boat through the Tapajos River. Fordlandia ultimately failed. Ford's dream was crushed without ever producing any rubber for his tires, and the city was abandoned in 1934. Back to Johan Johansson's fascination with the history. Johan writes, "One of the two main threats running through the music is this idea of a failed utopia, as represented by the Fordlandia title. The story of the rubber plantation Henry Ford established in the Amazon in the 1920s, and his dreams of creating an idealized American town in the middle of the jungle, complete with white picket fences, hamburgers, and alcohol prohibition. The project started because of the high price Ford had to pay for the rubber necessary for his car's tires, failed, of course, as the indigenous workers soon rioted against the alien conditions. The music is very simple. Like Ford's assembly line, it creates a powerful repetitive motion. Mirroring the idea of that assembly line in full power being shut down. The music gets louder and louder, repetitive, and at some point starts to slow down. A huge machine shutting down gradually. All its immense power coming to a complete standstill. The third piece of the program is Jean Sibelius' Symphony No. 7. Works of music are like time capsules, condensed forms of sound architecture that contain not only the soul of the composer, but also the soul of its time. The mindset of the time they were written in. Jean Sibelius is a child of the European Romantic era of the 19th century, standing on Beethoven's shoulders. Growing up in the harsh north. You most probably know Sibelius's Finlandia and The Swan of Tuonela. 3 years ago, we actually performed Sibelius's Symphony No. 2. Sibelius was born 1865 in a small town in the southern part of Finland. He studied the violin from an early age on, was very influenced by nature, and he started to compose as a teenager. His first work was a set of trios. He wrote in a letter at that time, "They, the trios, are rather poor, but it is nice to have something to do on rainy days." And as you can imagine, Finland has lots of rainy days. After high school, he moved to Helsinki to study music. One of his teachers was the Italian composer Ferruccio Busoni. But he knew he had to get out of Finland at some point. It was the end of the 19th century, and the musical world was focused around Paris, Berlin, and Vienna. He moved for 1 year to Berlin and 1 year to Vienna, 1889 and 1890. Keep in mind that this is the time of national composers. Remember our Ravel and Prokofiev concert and podcast last week? When Maurice Ravel was enthralled by the World Expo in Paris in 1889, Sibelius was in Berlin and Vienna, listening to performances of Wagner and Bruckner, and studying with Robert Fuchs and Carl Goldmark. It was truly a golden era of symphonic music. A year ago, you might remember, we performed Anton Bruckner's Symphony No. 7. Bruckner became Sibelius's greatest ever living composer. Sibelius wrote his first symphony rather late in life, with 34 years old. His second symphony was a huge success, and people wrote that his Symphony No. 7 is Sibelius's most remarkable compositional achievement. Besides his travels, Sibelius was most influenced by nature. His biographer wrote, "Even by Nordic standards, Sibelius responded with exceptional intensity to the moods of nature and the changes in the seasons. He scanned the skies with his binoculars for the geese flying over the lake ice, listened to the screech of the cranes, and heard the cries of the curlew echo over the marshy grounds just below Ainola, his country home. He savored the spring blossoms every bit as much as he did autumnal scents and colors." So much his biographer. Sibelius wrote in his diary in 1914, "The autumn sun is shining, nature in its farewell colors. My heart is singing sadly, the shadows grow longer. The adagio of my fifth symphony, that I, poor fellow, that I am, can have moments of such richness." And in 1905, he wrote, "Music is for me like a beautiful mosaic which God has put together. He takes all the pieces in his hands, throws them into the world, and we have to recreate the picture from the pieces." Before I talk more about his seventh symphony, let me set Sibelius' emotional and spiritual state of mind. Growing up in a Swedish-speaking household, he was most familiar with the works of the Swedish writer August Strindberg. His contemporaries in Berlin in 1889 actually included the painter Edvard Munch from the famous painting The Scream and the writer August Strindberg. Another big influence was the Christian Swedish mystic Emanuel Swedenborg. Because of Strindberg's influence, Sibelius bought a copy of Martin Lamb's Life of Swedenborg and said that he completely devoured it. Sibelius went on to say that Swedenborg's idea of everything being in divine harmony helped him to complete the writing of his fifth symphony, which he had been struggling with. Emanuel Swedenborg was a Swedish Baroque philosopher and mystic from the 18th century who had a huge influence over many artists, writers, and philosophers. Amongst them, William Blake, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Balzac, Dostoevsky, Carl Jung, Strindberg, etc. Swedenborg claimed that his entry into the field of theological study was in response to a divine vision and call, that his spiritual senses were opened so that he might be in the spiritual world as consciously as in the material world. Because of his otherworldly experiences, Swedenborg has often been regarded either as a spiritualist medium or as a mystic. August Strindberg, on the other hand, was a Swedish novelist, playwright, painter, etc. His novel, The People of Hemsö, is one of the most popular works describing a mindset and style of living in the rural Nordic countryside Sibelius was very much accustomed to. I won't get into the story. I only want to mention that the novel, The People of Hemser, plays with themes of rural isolation, life and death through the eyes of the seasons. In addition, light and darkness are important in the novel, setting the different moods. Strindberg describes the twilight and shining lights in that little village in Hemser. He paints vivid pictures of different kinds of flames, candles, the hot sun, of light reflected in bottles, in lanterns, of dusk and darkness. Strindberg's sensitive use of Impressionism represents a model of simple, uncomplicated life. And it is a book and a story that our composer Sibelius was aware of. Now, why am I mentioning Strindberg and Swedenborg? Because both give a feeling of Sibelius's mindset and view of life in the isolated North. Sibelius' last finished symphony, Symphony No. 7, took him about 10 years to write. 10 years! In 1918, he wrote, "The Seventh Symphony, joy of life and vitality mixed with appassionato." The idea is not fanciful, given what Sibelius told his son-in-law, the conductor Jussi Jalas, in the 1940s. Sibelius says, "The entire Seventh Symphony has very much in common with antiquity, especially Greece. The trombones are handed like the musical instruments of antiquity. The work is written in one movement, everything flowing organically from one into the next. The symphony is very often described as both a powerful picture of raw Nordic nature and a mystical narrative breaking through to glorious heavenly realms. The music starts with the low strings arising from the bottom of the earth. Immediately followed by held chords from minor to major keys, like a game of light created through sun and moving clouds. Moving further through two little motifs growing into the first theme, a calm chorale in the strings, religious and pure. The chorale is mutated, a continuous flow of colors through light and shadow, arriving in the second theme, heroic in nature, intoned through the trombone. A first breakthrough, a mystical vision. He named the second theme after his wife, Aino. Here we go. From here, he continues to unfold the music in the most organic fashion, like a plant, growing, sprouting, blossoming. The tempo is picking up, and we find ourselves in the third theme. Motives in 8 notes, bubbling upwards, until the beat pattern switches from a 3 to a 2 pattern. Maybe we just witnessed a change in the season, from winter to spring. Everything is alive and in motion. The music itself is difficult to pinpoint. It's almost like a soundtrack, emotional, subconscious. And we arrive in the fourth theme, played by woodwinds and horns. A hunter's call? Maybe we just arrived in time of autumn, or in the autumn of one's life itself? But that's not where we rest. Sibelius moves us forward and arrives again in the glorious second theme, played as a golden brass chorale. The work ends in C major in bright light, either external or internal, Strindberg or Swedenborg. It is visionary, majestic, and beautiful.